One day, a Monday, I'm walking across the Sony lot, and I see Denzel Washington, who at that time had won his Oscar for Glory, was a very well-respected actor, but wasn't the big movie star that he is today. And a little voice in my head said, go talk to him, which in retrospect was kind of absurd because I was, you know, this junior executive at a sister company, but I did. I introduced myself and I said, explained who I was. And I said, if you ever have any projects that you'd like to bring to Columbia, because he had a company at TriStar at the time, please let me know. He said, great. He said, let's get together tomorrow. So I was like, okay.
If you want to know how the story of meeting Denzel Washington on a studio lot ends, then I encourage you to keep listening to this episode of the Role Models podcast. Welcome to this episode. My name is David, and my guest is film and television producer Deborah Martin Chase. Before becoming an accomplished film producer, Deborah practiced as a lawyer, and we talk about the big transitions in her life and career. For example, how she decided to pursue her passion and follow her dream to become a player in the entertainment and movie business. Deborah was the first African-American female producer to work with a major Hollywood studio. She discovered people like Anne Hathaway or Blake Lively and produced blockbuster movies like The Sisterhood of Traveling Pants and The Princess Diaries. The movies Deborah has produced have grossed over $300 million combined. Deborah has some really great advice to share in this episode, like, for example, how to best enter an industry that you're not yet part of, but that you want to be. How taking a step back can often lead to two steps forward. And how following a little voice in her head led her to a big break in business. Towards the end of the conversation, Deborah shares some great pieces of advice that I really liked. For example, how to make the most out of the relationship with a mentor. Deborah just signed a producing deal with Universal Television, which means that we will soon be able to enjoy what she is creating right at this moment. This is the Role Models Podcast. This is episode 14. My name is David. Apologies for my little nasal voice. I'm dealing with a summer cold. And this is my guest, Deborah Martin Chase. Deborah Martin Chase, welcome to the Role Models Podcast.
Happy to be here.
Thank you for welcoming me to your home here in Los Angeles. You are a film and TV director, producer. And I can't wait to dive into your story, but I usually like to start this conversation by asking you, what is something that you are currently most excited about or most optimistic about?
I have a few things I'm really excited about. You mean in terms of my work? I am doing a movie on Harriet Tubman, the iconic spy, underground railroad conductor, you know, iconic woman. And we're going to shoot that later on this month with Cynthia Erivo, who just won the Tony for Best Actress in a Musical, and she's an amazing talent. And I also, there's a book that I am developing for ABC into a miniseries called The Black Calhouns, which was nonfiction, was written by Gail Lumet Buckley, who was Lena Horne's daughter. And it is the epic story of their family from the end of Reconstruction to the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. It's really an amazing book, and Casey Lemons is writing it, and we've just been digging into history, and it's been fun, and I think it'll be very special.
What is something like? What is something that you enjoy about that, digging into history, and what is that process like for you?
Digging into history, and in particular to American history and African American history, is ultimately a way of learning more about yourself. And because we are all the sum total of all of our experiences and what has come before us, and understanding family and putting family in context, and also understanding better where we are today. I always enjoyed history in school, and these projects are special.
When you say it's also a part of it is about learning about yourself in this most recent research, is there something you can share that you've learned about yourself?
You know, it's more, I mean, this ultimately, the Black Calhouns is about the establishment and growth of the African-American middle class in this country. And it's always important to keep yourself in context. So literally, you know, I feel very much like I'm standing on the shoulders of all these amazing people like Paul Robeson and Lena and you know, Thurgood Marshall, because I'm a lawyer as well. And remembering that I am part of their legacy is inspirational. And on those days where you're just like, why am I doing this? Why this is really hard? it helps you to know why you keep going forward.
It sounds like a super interesting project, and maybe we can get back to it later on. But I want to go back a little bit, and how just for listeners, can you describe a bit of your background, like where you're from, how you grew up, where you grew up, and help us understand what your personal history is like. Mm.
Well, I usually refer to myself as a gypsy in the sense that I grew up in a number of places, but my family home is Chicago, Illinois. My grandmother, since we're talking about history and legacy, my grandmother and her family migrated to Chicago from New Orleans in the early 1900s. She was Creole. And so that, you know, my parents were both born there. I was born there. We moved when I was 6 to Pasadena, California. And I was here, since we're in Southern California. I was here 6 through 15. And then at that point, my mother went back to school in her mid-30s to get her master's degree at the University of Massachusetts. So she carted 3 kids off in pursuit of her dreams. And I stayed behind and attended Mount Holyoke College. Actually did my junior year at Wellesley, but graduated from Mount Holyoke, then went to Harvard Law School. And then I married a classmate and moved to Houston and was a lawyer there and for about 4 years. And then my husband and I moved to New York. We separated while I was in New York. I stayed behind. And in 1989, I'd always wanted to do film and television. And my dad, to this day, is one of the biggest film and television buffs that I know. And so I was at that point in my life where it was time to either pursue my dreams or let them go. And I moved back to L.A. in 1989 to get into film and television.
Is there, during your childhood or growing up, is there something or someone who influenced that decision of going into film and television?
I'd have to say my dad. You know, he really, like I said, he loved, still does, loves movies. And so it was his interest, and also growing up in Southern California. I mean, it was around us. I mean, I think, you know, kids that grow up in Washington, D.C. probably have a special interest in politics, although I'm very interested in politics. And also, as I got older, understanding the impact that the images that I saw on screen had on me and my view of the world and of myself. And understanding that they were tremendously powerful and realizing that if I could take part in shaping those images and those messages and values, that could be my contribution to the world.
You said you always wanted to make film and television. Was this, do you remember when that happened? Like, when was this a moment? Was this a process? When did that happen in your life? This realization that this is something you always want to do?
You know, honestly, when I was little, I wanted to be an actress. So when I was 10 years old, I never forget, my parents always remind me, I wrote a letter to Walt Disney and said that, you know, I was a little 10-year-old black girl living in Pasadena, and how do I get into the movie business? Can you put me into the movie business? And actually, someone in his office wrote back a lovely letter that said, you know, basically stay in school and all things are possible. And you know, kind of funny aside on that is one of the makeup artists that I use and work with, her grandmother was Walt Disney's assistant for many, many, many years. And once I found that, I always suspected that she wrote the letter back to me, which I thought was very kind of great symmetry. But as I got older, I realized, which was true, just how insecure that business, you know, being an actor is like, you just don't know, you know. And in fact, when I first moved to New York as a lawyer, I auditioned for the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, and I got in. And I remember going home to my husband. I was like, should I do this? You know, it seems a little crazy. And so I ended up not doing it, but that desire was transferred into wanting to, it was still about creating and making films. And once I understood how the business worked, I realized that as a producer or as a studio executive, I could create stories.
I find this interesting because I saw, and you mentioned this, you went to law school, graduated from law school, and then you practiced as a lawyer. And you still applied for, audition for this, school.
Right?
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I find this a very interesting positive tension in a way, right? Like you are a lawyer, you practice law, but in your passion still lies in movie and television from a younger age on. And then you tried a little bit while you were a lawyer and then eventually transitioned into this. Can you talk a little bit about that transition?
From law to the film business. Yeah. You know, I reached a point in my life where I never loved practicing law. I was a very good lawyer and I was very successful at it, but I didn't love it. And I don't know if this is a strength or an indulgence, but passion about what I do has always been very important to me. And I guess I've been lucky enough to be able to pursue my passions. And I just got to the point where I realized this wasn't my contribution to the world. Practicing law wasn't going to be, wasn't in my heart for it to be. And I remember I was very active in the Dukakis presidential campaign. I always loved politics. I was a poli sci major. And at the end, I was on the national and state, New York State finance committees, and it was a delegate. And at the end, I was offered a job in the Dinkins administration in New York City. And it was like, you know what? This is my time to fly. This is my time to really, like, at least try to pursue this dream that I've always held on to. So I spent a year talking to everybody in the business who would talk to me and everybody they knew, and reading and going to seminars and stuff to understand how the business really worked and zeroing in on what it was that I wanted to do.
That's a really good point. I want to stop a moment because for people who are listening to this and who are in a similar position situation that you were in at the time, where it's like, okay, I studied this, I practiced this, I practice my discipline for some time. I'm realizing I don't love it. And I want to pursue something else. This is pulled to something else. What advice can you share to turn that dynamic of wanting to go do something else, but something's preventing you from doing it? What advice can you share for people to make the jump? And then I think what I found interesting as well is for you to go and talk to so many people in the business. And I'm curious about what kind of questions did you ask people? How did you get introduced to them? How did you get connected to them?
Mm. It's a combination of doing your own soul searching and homework, which in some senses is the hardest part of any transition, because generally when you enter that phase, you know what you don't want to do, but it's hard to pinpoint what it is you want to do. And you have to, I think you have to have a sense of that before you really start talking to people, because you know everybody's busy and you're reaching out to people in some cases that you don't really know. And I know I have a lot of people come to me, obviously, or you know. And if you can at least say, I'm thinking about doing this, can you tell me more about how this works? The more specific you can be with your questions, the more helpful people can be. But the first part of that, that internal process takes, you have to take the time to do it and to really listen to your own voice and think about what it is that's going to make you happy, what it is you want to accomplish, and find the motivation inside of you to do it. Because we all have things, you know, like we'd like to do this, I mean, we'd like to do that. But to really succeed at something, you have to have, there has to be a why I want this, what I will accomplish, how will this, what are my goals in doing this and in making this change?
Have you developed over time a process for this, or a mental model, like something that could be transferred onto other people, like acquired by other people? Like, is it, have you gone through this multiple times in your career? What advice can you share that?
You know, it's interesting. I have gone through it a couple of times, you know, to different degrees. And I am, in fact, I'm going through it a bit now, kind of at the other end of the process. And this time around, I have been thinking about what that process is, because I kind of, by default, just went into it without even thinking about, I got to do this step. And it really is the first thing that is, because in the beginning there's confusion and there's emotion and you're thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? This is, you know, and you have to spend that time, I think, with yourself answering those very fundamental questions. Like, what do I want out of this next step? What's important to me now? Because our priorities change as we go through life. And very clearly for me, what was important however many years ago when I originally made the transition, you know, has changed. I mean, then I wanted to prove myself as much as anything else. I was still at that point in my life and in my career. And at this point, I've done that. So it's really figuring out what is important to me right now and hopefully will be for the, you know, like the next 10 years. And like I said, once I think you've done that, then kind of naturally I've started talking to people who were doing things in a way that I thought I wanted to move towards, and really just how did you do it? You know, what is your infrastructure? Has it been successful for you? And so that you can learn from others' successes and mistakes. And I find that once you get to that point, they start to come together so you can start to make your own plan. Because you need a plan. You need a plan, and then you always get to that point where you got to jump off of a cliff in order to implement the plan. And you got to be willing to do that, which is scary, but I'm always like, if you don't jump, you're not going anywhere.
How do you, when you say it's scary, how do you play with those fears that are at play there?
I've gotten better at it as I've gotten older and been through it more, because I, you know, when you're younger, you don't know that which what you're afraid of is failing or falling on your face or, you know, failing, that's not going to work out. And I think that while my successes have been really important for me, my failures have been important as well. Because first and foremost, you realize, okay, so I failed. Like, the world didn't stop. You know, I can pick myself back up, keep going, try something else, try it again. And once you realize that you're not good, the world's not going to fall apart if you fail, then that lessens the fear of taking the jump.
So you're in, so now you're in the entertainment business, or you go out and talk to people and learn about the business, and talk about your first steps, your first foray into the movie business.
So I have a few funny stories. So this is a funny story.
Please.
So a friend's sister worked at Human Resources at Columbia Pictures. And I had arranged to meet with the general counsel, who was located in New York at the time. And he was running late. She was running late. And so I was waiting in my friend's sister's office, and she was gone, and I was snooping on her desk. And there was a memo about a new program that the chairman was starting to bring people from diverse backgrounds into the studio executive ranks. So when she came back in the office, I was like, I want to do this. Like, this is perfect. This is just what I need to transition. And she was like, well, it doesn't pay a lot of money. I'm like, okay, that's okay. I'm about the experience. I just need to get my foot in the door. So I ended up getting into this program. And it lasted only for 2 years. And there were about 10 of us in each year. And the program was designed so that you would spend 6 months in 4 different areas of the company. So you got an overview. I started in the legal department. They were shorthanded. They were getting an experienced, hungry lawyer for free. So it was like, it was fantastic for both of us. I ended up staying there for a year. It gave me a great foundation for how the company worked from a business perspective. And then I went to one of the lunches that the program set up, and there was a new chairman of the studio, a wonderful man named Frank Price. And I ended up being seated next to him, and we started talking. And Frank was at the time, he's still very much with us, kind of conservative on the face, buttoned down by Hollywood standards. And so when he found out I'd gone to Harvard, he said, oh, I have a book that I brought in with me that I really like that's set at Harvard, and I'd love to hear your what you think about it. This was on a Thursday. So I said, great. So I spent the weekend locked in my apartment. I read the book twice. I made my notes. And I called him first thing Monday morning. I said, oh, I had some time this weekend. And I took a look at the book, and he said, great. He said, why don't you come upstairs and we'll talk? And I did, and he liked what I had to say. And we kept in touch pretty actively over the next few months. And then he brought me on as his executive assistant, which was my big break. And, you know, in retrospect, Frank was one of the last of the old-fashioned studio bosses. This was his second time at the helm of Columbia Pictures. He'd also been at the helm of Universal Pictures and Universal Television, and just a really amazing, great guy. And he wanted me to learn. So I went with him to all of his meetings. I read scripts for him. I did special projects for him. And at the end of the day, we would sit in his office and I could ask any question that I wanted to. You know, why did you buy this? Why are you marketing this like this? And he really, you know, wanted me to learn.
What's the learning there for you and taking that opportunity that going into the movie business is maybe not the most glamorous job, but it's a job that exposed you to, took you really behind the scenes at the top level? Like, what is something that you can share in terms of advice for people who might consider a transition to career and maybe not aim for the glamorous job, but maybe the what appears maybe at first as a less glamorous job, but what is the takeaway or the long-term investment that then later pays off from that?
You want to get in a situation that where you can learn, where you have room to learn. And sometimes you have to take a step or two back in order to take two steps forward. I mean, you know, here I was an experienced Harvard Law graduate working as an assistant, but it was the best break I could have possibly had. I didn't make any money, but I came to look at it as my graduate school with huge benefits because I met all kinds of people and got to learn from somebody who was, you know, at the center of shaping the business. So I think ego needs to be, you need to keep your ego in perspective so that it doesn't get in your way. Because a lot of, you can say, oh, I'm too big for this, or I might be embarrassed, or, you know, what's to be embarrassed about? You're learning. You know, if you have a goal, you have to do what you have to do to get there.
What is something at a time that was for you the most profound learning that you've carried over throughout your career? Or was there one?
I don't know that there was one. I mean, there were many. I mean, he really opened the door into the movie business for me. And just to begin to understand on the creative side, story and what goes into making a compelling movie, and it's about characters, to just understanding the politics of the business, like who gets an audience, you know, who's respected, you know, and also just the realities up close and personal that it's a tenuous business. And people, I will never forget, Stanley Kramer, I will never forget, I had a little cubbyhole of an office. I mean, the equivalent of a broom closet that had been converted into an office. And a lot of, you know, older Hollywood people would come to Frank because he'd been around so long and he had the relationships. And so one day Stanley Kramer came to visit him. Now, Stanley Kramer, you know, award-winning, High Noon, but just one of the greats of our business, was probably in his 80s at that point and a little infirm. And as I recall, had a disaster where a business manager he was in need of money, sadly, at that point. And he had a book that he was trying to set up that was about Eleanor Roosevelt and her efforts to integrate the armed forces. And nobody on the creative staff would meet with him. They were like, they just treated him like he's not relevant. And I was like, this is Stanley Kramer. So I had him in my little cubbyhole of an office pitching me this story that we weren't going to buy. But I was incredibly respectful of him and who he is and what he had accomplished. But that's a lesson, like, people forget in this business. It's not like, you know, in law, where someone is a revered attorney, they will be revered for the rest of their lives. Hollywood's not really like that.
So you now you're a film and TV producer, and can you help us bridge that time from this first job as an executive assistant for head of a studio to becoming a producer? What was that transition like?
So Frank, after a year, Frank was ousted as head of the studio in a very ugly and public coup, which happens all the time in this town. And at the 11th hour, he gave me a contract, a two-year contract to stay at Columbia. And I wanted to go with him. And he was like, no, you really need to stay and be a full-fledged executive and have this as part of your resume. So I'd been there about 6 months. And as I have often said, I felt like the lone Democrat in a Republican White House. You know, my guy had left and I didn't really have a protector. So one day, a Monday, I'm walking across the Sony lot and I see Denzel Washington, who at that time had won his Oscar for Glory, was a very well-respected actor, but wasn't the big movie star that he is today. And a little voice in my head said, go talk to him, which in retrospect was kind of absurd because I was, you know, the junior executive at a sister company, but I did. I introduced myself and I said, explained who I was. And I said, if you ever have any projects that you'd like to bring to Columbia, because he had a company at TriStar at the time, please let me know. He said, great. He said, let's get together tomorrow. So I was like, okay. So he goes off his way. I go to lunch. I go back to mine, and I'm still in this broom closet office. I go back to my office after lunch, and my phone rings, and it's Doug McHenry. And Doug McHenry was a very prominent producer in Hollywood. He did New Jack City and a director as well. And a big brother to me. He had been ahead of me at Harvard and had always kind of looked out for me. And so Doug said, well, Deborah, I just hooked you up. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he said, I just had lunch with Denzel. And he said that he was looking for someone to run his production company. And I told him I had the perfect person, you. I said, well, I just met him 2 hours ago. And he said, yeah, he said the same thing. So the next day, I'm in my cubbyhole broom closet of an office. And my phone rings. And it's his assistant. And she says, will you be in your office for a while? Mr. Washington would like to come visit. I said, of course. And he showed up about, half hour later, very, incognito in jeans and t-shirt and a baseball cap. And we talked for about an hour and a half and realized that we very much saw the world in the same way and wanted to do the same things. And then a couple days later, he called Frank and asked Frank about me. And a week later, I went to go work for him.
What is something that you think he saw in you in order to give you the job to run his production company?
Shared values. I mean, I really was very much similar views on the world, similar life experiences, and similar goals particularly at that time, to make mainstream movies that either featured African Americans or cast African Americans in a blind way. So, they weren't necessarily about race, but were advancing the landscape by shattering images and stereotypes, wanting to do classy work that had a timeless quality to it. Wanting to both having a mission to change Hollywood and movies.
Which you then went and did. Like, what was some of the projects that you worked on with as a head of the production company of Denzel Washington?
Our first movie was Devil in Blue Dress. And sadly, we just lost Jonathan Demme, who was our partner on that. And then we did Courage Under Fire. And we did a documentary on Hank Aaron that was really that was, and that was the first thing I really hands-on produced. And Mike Tolan directed it, and it was really, I mean, it was nominated for an Oscar and an Emmy. It won a Peabody Award. I just went earlier this year to Hank's 83rd birthday party, and he created a Chasing the Dream Foundation behind the documentary, and he sent some 45 kids to college. I mean, it was one of those things that just was really great. And then I developed the what became The Preacher's Wife, which was based on The Bishop's Wife, and kind of found that because, you know, many considered Denzel to be Cary Grant-like, and at that point he hadn't done a romance or certainly a romantic comedy. And and that's how I met Whitney.
Whitney Houston. Mm. Before we move on to that part, the learning, it sounds like the learning from your first phase as a TV producer is to walk up to Denzel Washington and to say hi. Mm-hmm. Right, so it sounds like that's Wesley's second big break into the movie business. So what is there to share as advice in terms of overcoming or taking the courage to go speak to someone like him?
There's a fine line between being fearless and being arrogant or obnoxious, and it's finding that line, because you have to be fearless, you have to be aggressive, you have to put yourself out there, but you also have to do it in a way that has some humility to it and a sincerity. We all have people, you know, I got people calling me and all the time, and It's that very fine line between turning somebody off and having them notice you and bring you in.
I find this very interesting because the urge we sometimes have is to really, like in the time we're in right now, is this there's all these different channels in which we can access people. Right? There's social media, there's email, there's phones, there's introductions, warm, cold, whatever it is. And I was curious to see how do you navigate through that? Like, what do you choose to go after, and what do you decide to not go after?
You're right. I mean, people can come at you from so many different ways. Personally, I find it's hard for me to respond to a cold email. I mean, it just is. Unless there's something, I mean, if someone says, you know, if they went to Harvard Law School or they went to Mount Holyoke, I will pay attention to it because there's that common bond. But it's just, you don't know anything, you know. Like, to your point, I do a lot of public speaking, and I'm always amazed people come up afterwards and they're like, I need a mentor, will you mentor me? No, that's not, you know, just meeting you for 2 minutes, I'm not going to commit to do anything, you know, because so obviously personal introduction by a mutual friend is the highest thing, because that's how, you know, we all operate, and you're coming with not a stamp of approval, but with someone who's vouching for you, saying this is a worthy person and worth your time. And then there are times just where I mean I'm very observant, and I notice someone during the course of another interaction, and you just notice they're special. They just, how they handle themselves, how they perform, and that I'm obviously very open to. I mean, I've mentored a lot of people. I feel the responsibility because I was helped, and I feel responsibility to pay it forward. I think particularly for women and for, you know, ethnically diverse people, we have to look out for each other. But I've helped people across the spectrum, you know. And I'm always looking for just that person who is honest and sincere and totally committed to what they're doing and who's special.
Let's talk a little bit more about mentorship. This was we usually end talk about this topic of mentorship and role models later in the interview, but since you bring it up, what is, and I totally appreciate you saying, like, there's just too many people asking me to be their mentor, and you with your busy life and work can't commit to everyone. So when do you choose to commit to taking on a mentee, and what is it that they do to make the relationship, the mentorship relationship, worthwhile for you?
Starting with the last question, they make the mentorship worthwhile if they take advantage of the opportunity. And then it's just, I mean, listen, I've had, you know, Shonda Rhimes started as my intern. I've had a number of interns that have been great. She's probably the most famous. But she was at USC. I'd asked USC for a great student of color because I was running Denzel's company at the time. Shonda came. And as we got to know each other, it was clear that she was special and, you know, and smart. And I enjoyed being around her. So we spent more time with each other. And then I helped her get her first job. And I gave her first writing job on the Hank Aaron documentary. And kind of went from there.
To the idea of mentorship, what is something that good mentees do to make the relationship between a mentor and a mentee a good one, right? So it's one thing about asking someone to say, hey, I consider you a role model and I would love for you to be my mentor. And then you go, yeah, I see something in you, but here's how this is going to work. Right, it's like, is there a contract you make, informal, formal? Is there some sort of setup that works best for you? What are your expectation onto your mentee, and maybe what are the expectation of the mentee onto you as a mentor?
Yeah, I think.
Sorry, it's a lot of questions.
My expectation is that they continue to do well. That they continue to work hard, that they use whatever access and advice that I give them well. I don't expect anything in return. Although it's funny, now that I've got at this point in my career where I've had many, many people under my arm, now they're all doing their thing. And like all of a sudden I have this really great group of people looking out for me all over town, which wasn't the objective at the time, but it sure turned out, you know, well. And I go back to be specific. You know, it's one thing to come in and just want kind of general life advice, you know, general advice, like I'm in this job and it's not working and I'm thinking about doing this and I can give advice on that. But it's easiest if you come in with a question like, I'm thinking about doing this. What do you think about that move? Or more importantly, I want to do this. Who do you know that I can either talk to get more information or that can help me get a job? You don't want people to do your thinking for you. You want them to supplement and enhance the thinking you've already done.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. It's about asking very specific questions that make it easy for you to act on it.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Very, very great. I want to go back to Whitney Houston. So you met Whitney Houston after your time or during your time running Denzel Washington's production company. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, as I said, I had been developing The Preacher's Wife for a while, and she actually got involved early on. But I didn't meet her for a while. It was one of those, her team liked the idea, and it was she'd be able to sing, and I mean, it was just kind of a perfect role for her. So a meeting was arranged at her church, New Hope, in Newark, New Jersey. And we were supposed to have a big brunch afterwards, and her agents had set it up that we would step away and have some time together to talk and, you know, get to know each other. And I went to the church, and it was interesting to meet her for the first time in that environment because it was home. I mean, she had grown up in that church. They all knew her since she had been a little girl, and obviously the whole family was a real part of the church. Service started. She showed up about a half hour late and walked in, and it wasn't like, she didn't walk in like, oh, stop the services, you know, the star has shown up. It really was, I'm sorry I'm late, you know, and sat down and every, you know, knew everybody, and it was warm and home. So we go to this brunch afterwards. There's this huge table of people, and everybody's talking, and Penny Marshall was there as well. And so towards the end of the lunch, I pull one of the agents aside and I say, okay, well, you know, when are we going to spend our time together? And they said, oh, no, you're in. She likes you. You got the job. Which, you know, when people ask me about her, one of the things I always say, she was very instinctual. She had great instincts about people, about situations. And we just always got each other. Not like we didn't sit up nights, you know, pouring our hearts out to each other. I don't know if she did that with anybody, but we just, from that very beginning, we just got each other and fundamentally trusted each other. And as time went on, you know, she knew I always had her back.
And so I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about your involvement. So when you mentioned the letter that you sent as a 10-year-old to Walt Disney, and someone on his staff, or you assume someone on his staff replied, the Walt Disney comes back into your life, right, in a very important way as a company. You went on with in this involvement to produce some, you know, some real blockbusters, which totally grossed $300 million jointly. I want to let you talk about this a little bit, but I want to make sure we can take some time to talk about your time with the Walt Disney Company and your own company.
Mm. Yeah, how ironic that I then end up spending 20 years affiliated with the Disney Company. And so Whitney and I partnered, started a company at Disney. Joe Roth, who was then running the company, the motion picture studio, had been the first person to tell her that she was a movie star. And so they had a special relationship, and we ended up there. And so we did. So under the Brown House banner, we did Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, which to this day I have people telling me how much it changed their lives and it influenced them. And again, for me, throughout my Hollywood career, one of the important things has been to break down stereotypes, to change images, to change the dialogue and the narrative, and to inspire people, as I had been inspired as a kid, to know that they can do whatever they want to do. So Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella was a huge hit. I mean, it really was groundbreaking in its multicultural casting. Brandy had already been a star on Moesha, but it took her to another level. We did the Princess Diaries movies, so we discovered Anne Hathaway. She was 17 when she did the first movie. And they did very well. The Cheetah Girls was another kind of groundbreaking. There are generations of girls of all ethnicities in this country that I meet today who tell me how much those movies shaped and changed their lives. I mean, there's a young woman that I recently met, Danae Benton, who's starring in The Great Comet on Broadway. And a mutual friend took me to see it. And when I opened the playbill, she says that she decided she wanted to be an actress when she watched Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella. It told her that, you know, a young African-American woman could reach great heights. And I met her afterwards, and she's absolutely lovely, did a phenomenal job. And she just got a Tony nomination for Best Actress in a Musical. So that's what this is all about, is, you know, creating things that have that kind of impact on people. And that have that lasting impact. Yeah.
If I have a story that I want to pitch to you, what does Deborah Martin Chase look for in a story or in a pitch?
Well, I'll answer that by going. I'll finish answering the other one, and I'll incorporate that into it. So right after The Princess Diaries. Right as we were beginning to shoot the first Princess Diaries, Brown House ended at Disney. And right after Princess Diaries opened and it was clear it was going to be a big hit, Disney gave me my own deal. Nina Jacobson, who has been an incredible supporter of mine. And at the time, neither one of us realized it, but it made me the first African-American woman to have a producing deal at a studio. And then I spent another 15 years at Disney with my own company, but affiliated with Disney, and did stuff for everybody. ABC, what was then ABC Family, the Disney channels played a big part in my life. And then movies and TV shows around town. And it's interesting. What I look for great characters that I like to see the universal in the specific. So great characters in a story that resonates beyond the world that is being examined in the piece. I still feel like, you know, first and foremost, movies and television need to entertain, because that's why we're tuning in. But if along the way you can be given messages, or values can be reinforced, or your eyes can be open to something you might not have thought about or thought about in that way, that to me makes great entertainment.
And so these were important movies to put out there, and to the point that you now have people coming to you and say, hey, watching this movie influenced my path as an actor or as an actress. And you mentioned that one of those movies introduced Anne Hathaway as a young woman into to the world. And I was curious to hear about how you think about developing talent. Like when you see someone like Anne Hathaway as talent, what is it that you do to develop that talent?
It's not really for me so much developing the talent as identifying it. And then it becomes, you know, I will, as a person to person, give advice or, you know, help build their personal platform that will continue to support and nurture their career. I have discovered, quote unquote, a lot of people. I mean, Blake Lively, when we hired her for Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, she was 15 years old, Burbank High School, never got a paycheck before in her life. Jesse Williams, I put in his first movie. Lucy Hale, we put her in her first movie. She's become a big TV star. What I look for, it's hard to describe. It's, you look for, I say, like there's a light in someone's eyes that is reflective of intelligence and curiosity. You look for a confidence, but also humility to me is a very important quality. Because it means there's a vulnerability, that someone's in touch with their vulnerability. And I think that's important for a person, an actor, to be accessible to others. If you have that wall up, like everything's good all the time, I got Teflon on me, it turns people off. And then, you know, this is Hollywood, so you look for it. I look for an interesting face that is obviously attractive, but interesting, has character and personality. A perfect face is boring, but a face that is just a little, has its own signature, is one that coupled with charisma and light that you don't want to take your eyes off of.
This podcast is called the Role Models Podcast, and I was wondering who your role model is.
I don't really have one. And that's so funny. When I did my college interview at Mount Holyoke, they asked me that question, and I remember I didn't have an answer. And then finally I said, Jane Fonda, because that Jane was at her height of, being fabulous and political and a fabulous actress and all that. But at this point, I don't have one. I have women that I admire for things that they've accomplished and for the people that they are. But I, for better or for worse, have been on a kind of singular path. And so a lot of my path, I'm having to invent along the way still.
When you say a lot of the things you have to invent along the way, what advice can you share for people who are... who are in a role or in a company or in a career and they feel stuck. And what happens is that their voices in their head is preventing them from doing something or taking action. So you say that it's that you're still making it up along the way, which I think is a great learning and something to to incorporate way more into our lives, to understand that the career and the life is not such a straight line. It's a really long, winding road. And I was curious to hear if you have any advice to share for people who are stuck right now.
Okay, so this is going to sound, I don't mean for this to sound cheesy, but it's really true. So I heard this line years ago from Tony Robbins. And he said that, let me get this right, real change takes place when the pain of maintaining the status quo outweighs the pain of change. And it's really true. I mean, it's really hard to make the kind of changes that are going to turn your world upside down, because for the better, but it's still going to turn your world upside down, and that's a hard thing to do. And I think it really does get to that point where, for whatever reason, you're just like, I can't take this anymore. Now, to help facilitate that, you make a list of what are the pros of change, what are the cons of change. And again, going back to, at the end of the day, the thing that holds us back the most is fear. And so look at the fear and say, break it down. What am I afraid of? Okay, well, if this were to happen, how could I deal with that? And basically, if you lay it all out so that you can see and know that there's a small chance that you're going to end up in a worse situation than you are at present. And if you can plan for things that might not go how you plan and know that you can keep yourself on track, then hopefully you can get yourself to a why not place. If you can't get yourself to the, I just can't take this anymore.
If you look back at your career and you entered the film and movie business as a transition from practicing law, for people out there who are considering a similar transition, what is the best piece of advice you have received in the movie and film business that you can transfer onto to these people?
I don't know. I mean, not so much. I just know that the first job's the hardest job to get. And that's, it goes back to what we were saying earlier. So sometimes you may have to take a step or two back in order to go forward. And I've seen that a lot. You know, I had a young man who came to me as an assistant. He'd been an executive, you know, made like 3-4 times as much money, but didn't love it. And he started over as an assistant, and now he's a senior VP at a major production company and just doing amazing work. But just know that you kind of need to do what you need to do to get your foot in the door. And then once you're in there, you know, work hard, make your relationships, listen, learn, read. I mean, I find also people don't do as much homework as they need to. And okay, this is another like really random weird quote that has stuck with me for years. But I remember I read this in the New York Times from Bruce Willis, and he said, "You know, success happens when opportunity meets preparation." So basically, you know, you're looking for opportunity. You're looking for that kind of, you know, chance encounter on the lot that can change your life, but you need to be prepared. So when that door cracks open, you know how to step through and take it from there. Nobody's going to say, okay, I'm going to crack the door from you, and then I'm going to give you 6 months to go back and do your homework. And I find that in life in general, when you have done the work, when you have prepared yourself, whether that be professionally or personally, that things come to you when you're ready. And if you don't do the work and you're flailing around and why isn't this happening? And then, 'cause you're not ready.
Yeah. Do your prep work, do your homework. What is the, we ask this question every guest on the podcast and also in the event series that we host in Berlin. And it's usually the question we end up on and that we end with. What advice would you give your 14-year-old self?
That's actually kind of tough. 'Cause I was always a real risk taker, you know. Probably, well, my 14-year-old self, I think myself now or, you know, later. Just to, honestly, I don't have a good answer for that one. I wasn't afraid, and I did take a lot of chances. And I did trust myself, which might have made me an unusual 14-year-old. I don't have an answer.
Well, be fearless, that it was, right? Mm. Deborah, thank you so much for your time. Been very generous with your time and with this lovely view onto Los Angeles. Thanks for having me. Thanks for coming on the podcast. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you. Been a real pleasure.
Hey, this is David. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Role Models Podcast. If you liked this episode, you can do us a big favor by rating and reviewing this podcast on iTunes, and then to also share the link to this episode with your friends on social media. This will help our Role Models guests get their story heard by more people out there. We appreciate it, and they do too. If you would like to share any feedback with us or ideas for guests we should have on our show, please reach out on Twitter @RoleModels and @David. Thank you.